What's happening, everybody? And thanks for tuning in to the Crash Bang Boom podcast. Today's guest is someone I've been looking forward to speaking with for quite some time, a drummer, instructor, author of Rhythm and Drumming Demystified, and more, and Dave DeCenso. Dave and I got to talk about hearing loss and getting through a tough period in 2020 when faced with the grim task of questioning his ability to continue his livelihood and love in music and instruction. And as for the instruction part of that equation, he's been teaching at Berkeley now for 27 years. So I'd say we spent the better part of the first quarter of the interview going through that tough year of 2020 before getting to the Cro-Mag stories, as well as pondering some of my questions about the origins of modern drumming trends and how we see them play out, especially in isolated environments such as social media, etc. So anyways, I hope y'all dig it. Also, shout out to drummer Ash Pearson of Revocation, who originally hit me to Dave DeCenso. Props, my dude. Crash Bang Boom Podcast can be found on iTunes, Podcast, Spotify, Stitcher, Luminary, Google Play, Podbean, Amazon Music Podcast, and more. Feel free to check out any of the previous 200 episodes and give me a like and or a subscription and or a positive review. The support is appreciated. Shout out to my sponsor, New Orleans Record Press. If you're looking to release some vinyl, hit them up at neworleansrecordpress.com to check out all the electroplating, mastering, design, packaging, and vinyl coloring options. And they got a handy little real-time quote generator for you to keep tabs on it all. They also print 12 and 7-inch records in 150 and 180-gram variants, and they do small runs of 100 and larger runs up into the thousands. So hit them up, and that's neworleansrecordpress.com. As we hopefully near a time where we can get back to live shows in the near future, do keep tabs on artist live streams, lessons, tutorials, and master classes, such as ones offered from today's guest and drum and master Dave DeCenso, as well as merch and or physical releases that are for sale from your favorite artists. And lastly, keep tabs on websites like Save Our Stages looking to assist live venues who are very much struggling in this day and age. So without further ado, here we go. Cheers to the light at the end of the tunnel. Dave DeCenso. Crash, bang, boom. I'm here with the one and only drummer and teacher extraordinaire. I'm definitely excited to talk to him. Dave DeCenso, what's happening, my man?
Hey, Jody. Not much, brother. Actually, a ton, but, you know, that's how life goes.
Yeah, man. How was 2020 for you, man, being a teacher and whatnot? What did that mean in being a teacher and doing what you had normally been doing otherwise?
2020, fortunately, was, as far as my teaching, you know, I was able to transition to remote teaching. I had not done hardly any online teaching. Occasionally I would, you know, take a friend or a former student at Berkeley and just do like a Skype lesson, sort of a one-off with just like, you know, just laptop audio, laptop camera. It was, you know, pretty low grade.
Yeah.
And I was purposely staying away from online teaching because I teach, you know, I teach at Berkeley and I teach at my house anyway, in person, at least I was.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I didn't really have a reason to do online teaching. So it was brand new and it was a learning curve. I disliked it very much at first. And I've grown since then to enjoy aspects of it very much, actually. Yeah, so 2020 could have been a hell of a lot worse for me and my family. And I'm, I feel fortunate and I'm grateful that it wasn't.
Yeah. Damn, man. Did you find yourself doing anything unexpected with some of that downtime, be it digging into particular records or doing yard work or just whatever, man?
Well, my wife went pretty gung-ho into home renovation,
mm-hmm.
You know, painting. She did a lot of work, man. Her dad helped her out. My father-in-law helped her out. I didn't feel like I had a ton of downtime. I suppose over the summer I did, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually going through a very dark time over the summer, which was, I discovered in May after an audiogram, a hearing test. I knew I had a lot of hearing loss, but mm-hmm. I found out just how much. And in 2020, man, it's actually a long, convoluted story, and I think I'm going to refrain. I'll tell you basically that I found out how much hearing I'd lost. I saw it. It was something about the visual and putting the visual together with just the experience of just not hearing, you know, stuff anymore. Like, you know, my wife just in the next room over talking to me. Sometimes even at the dinner table, just at the dinner table, I'd be saying what? You know, I was saying what a lot in my life. And it was negatively impacting my family life with my wife and my son. They would both get annoyed, as would I, actually.
Of course.
I think I probably got more annoyed than they even did.
Yeah.
Just, you know, like they didn't want to be repeating themselves all the time. And I didn't want to be saying what. And I also at times just thought like people were mumbling, you know. And so it was very... It was very difficult. I got that hearing test result and went into pretty much straight into a depression.
Yeah.
Based in fear and not knowing. I didn't know exactly how I'd lost so much hearing, and I did not know exactly what the hell I was going to do going forward. Yeah. You know, going forward. So I felt my livelihood was very much being threatened.
Oh,
and my joy in life, you know, outside of my family and friends, you know?
Yeah.
So I ended up getting help. I did a lot of meditating, reading. I started jogging. I quit smoking. Stuff like that, man. Yeah. Stuff like that. That's kind of what I was up to.
Crazy.
I got a lot of help too. My friend Hari, great friend of mine, great drummer. He's had, you know, problems with his ears for years, and he hooked me up with his audiologist. And then, you know, I have a couple of extremely close friends that are like brothers to me. And one of them in particular, I leaned on very heavily during that time. You know, he was there, man. You know, I like to try to offer things, you know, when I do these interviews. And one thing I feel that just popped into my head is be a good friend to people, you know, just be a good friend to someone, you know, be a good friend.
Sure.
Because you should be a good friend anyway, because it feels good and it's a good thing to do, you know.
Yeah.
But me and this guy, my buddy Joe, we're just there for each other. My buddy Rich, too. Not buddy Rich, but,
yeah.
You know, my buddy Rich.
Yeah.
You know, we lean on each other pretty heavy sometimes, man. And I leaned on him harder than I think I've ever leaned on anybody over the summer. And he was there very much so. Like,
nice.
Frickin', like, I was desperate, man. I was desperate.
I bet, yeah.
And he was very patient, man, taking my calls and just, like, listening to me, like, fucking talk circles, you know, like, trying to figure out what I should do and... You know, how was I going to get through this? And, you know, I was in panic mode.
Totally.
So anyway, that was part of my exciting 2020.
Oh, man. Wow.
And that's when you actually called me first to see if I wanted to connect to do an interview.
Yeah.
And I was all about it, but I had just hit that wall with my ears when you first contacted me.
Yeah. Damn, man. Well, better late than never, and I'm certainly glad to be speaking to you now. So, my God, man. You'd mentioned that you weren't really certain as to what attributed to the hearing loss in the first place. I mean, were you always pretty consistent with wearing hearing protection throughout the years?
In 2006, I did a gig with no hearing protection. And, and it was the first time in a while I had done that, because I'd been very, you know, cognizant of my ears and, you know, the health of my hearing for a while at that point in 2006. And I did this gig and it was really loud. And I was doing a gig with a band I'd never played with before. And I really wanted to hear what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounded great. And it was a blast.
Yeah.
No pun intended. But,
right.
You know, but I had my monitor level way too high.
Uh-huh.
And it was, you know, it was like a three set night. So it was a long gig.
Wow.
And I came home that night. Yeah, it was a local thing. And my ears were just ringing louder than they ever had before.
Mm.
And And so, you know, I knew I did something. I knew I did something bad. And I went and got my hearing tested. And sure enough, you know, so 2006, I'm like 38.
Mm-hmm.
I had, I think, what they called mild hearing loss, pushing into moderate, you know, at that point already. So, yeah, so, you know, at that, from that point forward, I was very vigilant, extremely vigilant.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine that I did a few tours, a few world tours with Josh Groban starting in 2011. And it was the first time I'd done in-ears.
Ah.
I think that contributed to it. I can almost guarantee I did not have the proper in-ear monitors. I did not have silicone. I had the hard plastic ones. I forget what they're called, what that material is made of. But it's got no give to it.
Mm-hmm.
You want to get a something soft to go into your ear, something with some give, some pliability to go into your ear canal. And you want it to go in deeply into your ear canal. And these in-ear monitors that I used over the course of these few years that I was touring with Josh were acrylic. And I was playing behind plexiglass a lot. At some points, I was surrounded in plexiglass. It was loud. I think I acclimated to it. And I would walk after every show, man. I would walk off the stage. I'd pull my in-ears out, and I'd plug my ears with my fingers. I wouldn't plug them. I'd shut them with my fingers.
Yeah.
Just to listen to my ears, see how they were ringing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were ringing, but it wasn't going crazy. And I also was not getting pain in my head, which would often happen to me when exposed to something loud, whether it was for a long period of time or just something really loud, you know, a one-time instance that was, you know, like a gunshot or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I figured I was okay. I don't think I was, man. I think that definitely contributed to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no way of knowing for sure.
Right. Yeah. Wow.
And then I would occasionally, I would drop my guard a little bit with tuning drums in particular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't protect my ears when tuning drums. It's kind of hard to do. You know, it's like you want to hear the whole voice, you know, the whole spectrum of the voice. So I became a tuning nerd somewhere around 2013 or 14. Uh-huh. I just, for the first time in my life, I think I got good at it.
Yeah.
And I became extremely interested in it, and you know, I would experiment with heads and different intervals between the top and the bottom, and I kind of went down the rabbit hole there, and I would often be hitting the drums, never a snare drum, but the toms and the bass drum. I would hit them loud, I would hit them hard to, you know, when I wanted to hear the drum at, you know, a loud dynamic.
Yeah,
I think that maybe my audiologist says, nah, toms, you know, toms shouldn't really do that. They shouldn't.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, you know, I got a meter, a decibel reader.
Mm-hmm.
I set it up and I went through all the drums, just hitting them one by one and looking at the meter. And man, the kit that I was using was a 12, 13, 14, 16, two up, two down.
Yep.
Hit the 12, and it was like, you know, I wasn't beating the shit out of it, and it was like 108 decibels easily. Just, you know, just laying into it a little bit, not really much.
Mm-hmm.
And the 13 was a little quieter, 14 a little quieter, 16 a little quieter still.
Mm.
And incidentally, I had the decibel meter behind me, so the 12 was the farthest drum from it, and it was still the loudest. So I'm not convinced that, you know, toms don't hurt your ears.
Right.
Not to mention a bass drum, man. If you know how to, if you hit a bass drum, you know, and you're aiming to get volume out of it, you can make a bass drum freaking scream, man.
Of course.
You know, it can be really loud. So these things could have probably did contribute. Plus, I was doing, starting in about 2015, I started doing some local gigs. And some of those gigs got loud. I always had protection.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, there's no, you know, it's like, I can't guarantee that I didn't, even with protection, even with 25 decibel filters. And here's some more information. Just because you have a 25 decibel filter in your hearing, in your earplug,
mm-hmm.
doesn't guarantee you that you're getting that 25 decibel cushion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've tested different filters and different earplugs with my audiologist, and some are, you know, more effective than others.
Yeah.
So it's tricky. And last thing I'll say about the hearing is you don't know how susceptible you are to hearing loss. Some people are more susceptible to hearing loss than others.
Yeah.
Just like some people are more susceptible to any other physical ailment mm-hmm. than other people, you know? So you really got to be careful. You could be 70 years old and, you know, have very little hearing loss and have been, you know, a musician all your life. Or you
right.
could be 70 years old and have massive hearing loss
totally.
From being a musician all your life.
Yeah. 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 The spectrum is crazy, right?
It really is, man. And you don't, you know, like the two 70-year-olds didn't have to act differently either.
Right.
Like both people could have not protected the ears. One ends up with very mild hearing loss and one ends up with severe hearing loss.
Yeah.
So I think that's an important message to get out there. That had never occurred to me, you know,
right.
that I might be more prone to it than others.
Mm. Crazy, man. My goodness.
Yeah, man. I'm doing okay now though. You know, like I'm doing okay. I'm more than just functioning. I'm actually sort of back to mostly feeling normal.
That's good.
And it's an incredible experience, man, with the technology.
Right.
As you know, such as it is, having so much hearing back when I put my hearing aids in.
Wow.
It's really amazing. And like I've got an app for my hearing aids, and there are three programs. And, you know, one is for like one-on-one conversation. One is for conversation in a crowd, and one is for music.
Uh-huh.
Just all three of those are kind of cool. Like I can hear better just in my personal conversation. I can hear better when I'm in a crowd, which is unbelievable because
right.
that's where I've suffered the most. I think that's where most people with hearing loss suffer the
yeah.
most. Once you get in a crowd, man,
for sure.
You know, yeah. So.
Wow.
And then the music is pretty amazing. You know, if you get an audiologist who knows how to do it, maybe they all know how to do it. I wouldn't imagine they all do, like, know
yeah.
how to, like, or maybe they just do. Maybe they just dial in that program.
Right.
You know, I don't know either. So, but in any case, you know, there are some amazing aspects of getting, you know, the hearing aids.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. Did you see that that movie, The Sound of Metal, by any chance? Because that one scared the hell out of me in the sense that they sort of simulated what it was that he was hearing, having completely lost his hearing and then using hearing aids for that. And I guess maybe that was different. I also don't know how accurate their depiction of what it was that someone would hear through hearing aids, having completely lost their hearing, which I think is what he had. But it sounded like such insane sort of digital noise that I was just like, oh, that would completely change your perception of what you were playing, everything about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good to hear you say that with those few different settings, you've been able to adjust yourself within a different environments, and that you're actually hearing more. And that's really good to know, because I too have had some hearing loss, and I haven't had my hearing checked in a long time. But a lot of the symptoms that you're talking about, crowds, et cetera, feeling like people are mumbling, I get all that stuff. And I always protected my ears. But again, to your point, some people are more prone, more susceptible to this than others. And clearly, I guess I'm one of those people that is a little more susceptible to it. So, yeah, it's crazy, man.
Yeah. You know, and I spoke with another good friend of mine about this early on. My friend Adam Deitch, former student of mine,
of course.
The great drummer Adam Deitch.
Yes.
He said something to me, man, that stuck with me, and it was helpful. He said, you and thousands of us. He just, you know, illuminated the fact that a lot of people suffer from hearing loss, and not just musicians, obviously, but a ton of musicians. You know, and if you're over 40, chances are and you're a musician, you probably spent some time playing music without protection, if not years like I did.
Yeah.
And I used to hit hard, man. I play, I came up in the metal scene.
Totally.
And I was, it was part of my MO. I was one of the hardest hitters, around. It's so not my MO anymore, but that's what I was coming up, man. I hit the drums really hard, and I didn't hit them with as much grace as I know how to do it now. So I was probably creating even a sharper, more abrasive tone at the time than I do now. So going back to your question, I did not see that movie yet, and I do want to see it. It came out right around the same time that I was I hit this wall and I just went down.
Yeah.
And I was afraid.
I hear you.
I was interested, but afraid to watch that movie. And now I'm ready. I want to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, man.
Well, the hearing that you get back is, there's an artificialness to it, and you do get used to it. When I first walked out of my audiologist's office with my new hearing aids, the whole world just felt loud and sort of like there was sort of a tinge of just like this artificialness to everything. And I don't know how better to put that right now. So it's, I guess I'm just sharing that because it's not perfect. It's a hell of a lot better than it sounds like what that guy was dealing with in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't perfect. But and again, if anybody's listening and is having hearing issues, you can get help. It is expensive, unfortunately.
Well, yes, it is.
You know, it's really, really expensive still. Hopefully that'll change. But if you can manage it, I feel like the quality of my life has been, I would say, significantly improved, if not vastly improved.
Wow.
With hearing aids.
That's great to hear, man. Well, you had mentioned coming up in metal and this and that and the other, and I'll definitely ask you about some of the gigs that you played in those times. And it's funny, in researching more and more about you, I definitely ended up watching that Two Ton Shoe, some of that stuff on YouTube, and my God, your drumming is crazy town during that phase. It's absurd. It's so good, but it's so funny, to see you with your long hair and the whole thing. So I guess, for those that don't know, you obviously grew up, your father was a drummer, a teacher as well, correct?
Correct. Yes. My first teacher.
Your first teacher. Amazing, man. And what age did you start playing?
Start playing is sort of a loose term. I mean, there are pictures of me when I was 18 months old sitting at my dad's drums.
Wow.
Trying to play like with a serious expression.
Yeah.
And then, I remember distinctly, man, it's so bizarre. I very distinctly remember my dad coming up from the basement where he had his studio. He came up from a day of teaching or maybe an evening of teaching, whatever. He comes upstairs, and I was 4 years old. I remember looking up at him. I remember, being really small and, pressing him for drum lessons. And and I remember being disappointed that he wouldn't do it until I was five. Somehow he came up, or maybe he and my mom came up with that number, like, let's wait. And it was probably a very good decision because even at five, I did not like drum lessons.
Right.
And yet I was adamant. I really for whatever reason, felt like I should be taking drum lessons at 5 years old.
Right.
And it was no fun, man. It was no fun. But, you know, those were my beginnings. I started very young. And then I stopped for a while, and I played guitar. I took guitar lessons from about 10 to 15 years old. My first bands that I was ever in, I was a guitar player. Before I went back to playing drums, like a year before, my dad took everything out of the house and brought it all to this drum shop that he opened. And then by the time I got to high school, I had decided I wanted to, you know, make drumming my career. Mm-hmm. And then I went, signed up for lessons again with my dad, and enjoyed the lessons the second time around. My dad was a great teacher, man. Really great.
Yeah.
I don't blame him for not liking my lessons as a youngster. I don't think anybody could have made me enjoy trying to memorize the definition of a time signature and the note values and, like, why? You know, I had my 45 records. I had a good collection of 45 records. You know, I'd get them for Christmas and birthdays and buy them with allowance. I'd spin them on my dad's turntable and, you know, run around to the drums, and there were big floor speakers on either side of the drums. And I would have the time of my life playing along to all my 45s. And the drum lessons just seemed, I wasn't able to make the connection yet. Like, okay, so I've got playing the drums with music, like fun off the charts. Taking drum lessons, no fun.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't compute. But he was a great teacher, and I always say, you will not find a better first teacher, because my dad, well, you wouldn't have. He passed in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was the type of teacher, if you come to him as a beginner, he is going to give you a well-rounded education.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite a gift, because it's a rarity, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't even know how to do that, don't have the patience to do that, don't think it's necessary to do that. So I'm very grateful for that. And like I said, the second time around was fun. I started to get it. And by the time I was like 19, maybe 20, it just clicked. It really clicked, like just becoming a literate musician.
Mm-hmm.
I started to understand the language. I also started to understand the value in understanding the language.
Sure.
And the freedom, you know, that it gives the artist.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand where you're at and what you're doing, and how to do it, it's I always say the challenge should be the music, not the rendering of the music.
Uh-huh.
You know, we shouldn't be challenged by having to be conscious of the way we speak any more than I'm conscious of the way I speak right now. Like, I'm not thinking about the words.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to. I just have to stay in on topic.
Yeah.
So it started to dawn on me and click. And from, you know, from there on, I was, I was just inspired. I was excited. I was into it. I was able to start teaching now that I understood the theory and how to transcribe, and it was great, man. The last time I took a lesson, I was 21 years old, and it was with Gary Chafee.
Oh, nice.
And by the time I was 21, I understood enough for me to really take it on my own. You know, I've been teaching at Berklee for a long time, College of Music.
Yeah, 26 years, right?
Yeah, 26 years, man, since 94.
Oh, wow. That's even longer. Damn. Okay, 27, I guess. My math
we'll
sucks.
Call it, let's call it 20. No,
yeah, right?
I feel very fortunate and grateful that I was given the tools to do that, to cultivate myself.
Yeah, right. When you think back to sort of the early 90s when you were playing with Cro-Mags and everything, which is really interesting because it sounds like you had studied a good bit, and then you end up playing with a relatively, I would say, kind of straightforward, kind of hardcore style of a band in Cro-Mags. What was it like getting in with that band, who is a very, very New York band? You're a Boston guy. Was it wild in the early 90s, and what were some of the crazier shows, I guess, that you had played at the time, really?
It was so much fun, man. You know, I was pretty insecure, man, about myself as a person. I knew I was secure about my skills as a drummer in the context of metal, hardcore, prog, you know, hard rock. I was very confident in my skills, but I was not really confident in myself yet. And, you know, I struggled with that for a long time. So, you know, there was definitely some just feeling a little out of place.
Of course. Those dudes were fucking hardcore, man. The crowd, the scene, that culture was a very hardcore, in your face, pretty aggressive culture. So if you're having some self-doubt issues, I can see how that may be an issue.
Yeah, you know, and I didn't feel as like worldly as these guys growing up in New York City. I grew up in a suburb of Boston.
Uh-huh.
And I was metal, and, you know, they were metal, but they were more hardcore than metal. It was like they had fused the two styles quite well at that point.
Sure.
They were one of the original bands to ever do that. But it was definitely like the culture was very, like you alluded to, is very different than the culture of metal. They shared some similarities. I don't know, man. It was a little scarier in a way.
Absolutely.
You know, like people show up to shows, you know, like wanting to fuck people up. Like, you know, people in the band, you know,
right.
Like people would show up knives. You know, there was a gun incident one night in Detroit.
Oh, boy.
You know, we fled the damn city, man. You know, like we were in our hotel room chilling, lighting up the first spliff, and we get a phone call. You know, this is way before cell phones. You know, the telephone rings, and it's our tour manager, you know, saying, get back in the van and, you know, get on the highway. We're fucking out of here. And we drove from Detroit to Chicago that night. I believe it was Chicago. And,
wow.
So, it was crazy. The culture was different. I felt a little green, if you will. And at the same time, man, I was having a blast.
Right.
I had a friggin' blast. And, you know, these guys were like, especially Harley, you know, just tough guys.
Totally.
You know, tough guys.
Absolutely.
And I was, you know, I grew up trying to be a tough guy. Not like trying to hurt anybody, but just like trying to, you know, like come off as like, don't fuck with me,
uh-huh.
You know? And just sort of a survival skill, you know, like,
sure.
I don't want to be fucked with. Who does want to be fucked with? Nobody
right.
wants to be fucked with. So I developed this sort of like, you know, hard exterior, but underneath, you know, there was just a lot of insecurity. And so I suppose there was even maybe a little intimidation factor, you know, involved as well.
Uh-huh.
But dude, overall, man, I just had such a good time. Touring with the Cro-Mags was my first ever touring experience.
Uh-huh.
Man, I pine for it at the moment. Like, I can remember it was a summer tour. And it was just, there was a lot of magic to it. Just hours, you know, looking out the window, listening to, I remember I had Hemispheres, Rush's Hemispheres on cassette in my Walkman.
Yep.
You know, for the trips. I had several cassettes.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Like, you know,
I know.
I had, you know, maybe a half a dozen cassettes with me on for like a month long tour, you know, versus
right.
today, what you could do.
Right.
But just some heavenly memories, man. One of my favorite parts of the music industry, very most favorite parts of the music industry, is meeting people, whether they're musicians or fans or whatever, or someone in the airport, you know, whatever. I've always, love that, especially not so much the airport hangs. I could do without those, but the after hangs, you know, backstage or at somebody's, you know, house after the show, before you go to the next city, just meeting strange people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll always love that. As much as I don't like many things about being on the road, that's something I love and would never get tired of. So yeah, man, the Cro-Mags experience was awesome overall.
Yeah.
And I did a bunch of recording with them and probably lost some of my hearing with them too.
Yeah. Right. Oh my God. I bet. Jeez Louise. I have one of the questions that I've been wanting to ask you the most is a conversation that I've sort of had over the course of some of these previous episodes and whatnot. When I studied down in New Orleans, I had a couple of really great drum teachers. And then fast forward to more recently with, you know, the internet, YouTube, and every sort of fascination with, I think, maybe could stem back to the Guitar Center drum offs and that being sort of an outlet for kids and sort of the vocabulary that I think came from maybe like the church and to that place. And then via YouTube and via Instagram and social media in general with the sort of fireworks nature of it, it's become quite a point of interest and a more common vocabulary. So I'm just kind of curious sort of what you tie that back to, because I remember the first time I heard anything sort of like that. And again, I'm whether you call it gospel chops or 32nd note, you know, patterns over the course of sort of halftime grooves and just trading licks and some of the stuff that again kind of came out of the church from what I've heard. A lot of people seem to reference Vinnie Caliuta. So I was curious from your perspective, especially as a teacher and at a place like Berkeley, no less, what do you attribute some of that vocabulary too? Is there any particular person? Because I know in the case of, for instance, like Steve Smith and Vinny himself, they both studied with who you had mentioned, I believe, Gary Chaffee. So does it tie back to Gary Chaffee? And what do you sort of give that lineage to?
That's a good question, man. I don't know that I could comment on Chaffee so much, you know, so much as I could comment on Vinny, you know.
Sure.
You can listen to Vinny and you say, okay, that's Vinny. You don't know really what coming out of Vinny is stuff that he, you know, directly got from Chaffee, you know, how
sure.
he was influenced conceptually,
uh-huh.
By Chaffee's concepts, I should say. But my take on it is chops have always been a fascination.
Sure.
Right? I mean, Buddy Rich, still people will, I still like to go watch Buddy Rich solos.
Absolutely.
From time to time. It's just unfrickin' believable.
Yeah,
you know?
It's crazy.
So, you know, there's been this longstanding fascination. It's just, it has shifted. It's become, I suppose you could say it's become more of a focal point in the eyes of, in the consciousness of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it probably comes from Gad, Vinny, Dennis Weckl.
Uh-huh.
You know that Buddy Mitch, Buddy Rich Memorial scholarship video, right, with the three Weckl and Gad and Vinny?
Of course.
Right, and you know, I think that, you know, if you put Dennis on that stage, you know, like it would have been, he would have fit right in.
Totally.
They had a sound that was different. It mm-hmm. was more contemporary when it came out. It was very, especially Weckl's was extremely clean and pristine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was just a beautiful component to the, just sonically speaking, it just sounded so good.
Mm-hmm.
And Gad, he had a little bit of that raw, dirty, you know, not pretty sound.
Absolutely.
But there was also this definition to the sound. It was like a short sound, a thuddy sound.
Oh, his drum sounded borderline crazy. It's hilarious when I listen back to it. I'm like, Jesus, Gad, are you playing cardboard on top of those toms? What is going on here, dude? Jesus.
Yeah, but check this out. So, you know, when you start playing like 32nd notes around toms that are headed and tuned as such, that vocabulary takes on a different persona, almost like a different, there's a different texture to it. It's a little more defined than, say, like an open black dot, you know, sound on both sides, like Tony did, or right. ambassadors on both sides and wide open. It's a different sound, and it became all the rage, man, in the mid '80s, and I think you got a large demographic of young African American drummers who started to put their own spin on that Gad Vinnie Dennis Weckl kind of thing. You know, with that same sort of sound, you still hear that like sort of pristine, you know, like do 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 do. You know, that kind of sound, you still hear that in a lot of the gospel, you know, for lack of a better term, the drummers who do, you know, gospel chops, so to speak.
Right.
It's that same sound. There are contemporary drummers who are playing a lot of notes, again, for lack of a better term.
Sure.
With a different sound. Mm-hmm. Even like a guy like Nate Smith, like his sound... little, not so do do do, not so much that, a little more raw, a little uglier, that Ludwig sound.
Yeah, I think you're both, not just because y'all both play Ludwigs, but I think y'all both have tonally, more, what would maybe be more tied into maybe someone like, I mean, Mike Clark probably tuned it up a little bit high, but more of that sort of jazz funk kind of tonal tuning as opposed to something else, maybe.
Exactly. So, you know, we do have these guys like a Mark Juliana, you know, Nate Wood.
Oh, yeah.
All these guys who can play a lot of notes and do at times with a decidedly different sound than that other sound we're talking about. And I think, like I said, I would attribute it largely to black culture in America, you know, putting their spin on the... what was the sort of contemporary way of playing, you know, a lot of chops,
right?
I.e. those cats.
Mm-hmm.
You hear a lot of them mention Vinny and Weckl.
Yes.
You know, and Gad.
And Dennis, for sure.
And Dennis, for that matter, right?
Absolutely.
So I think that speaks a lot to the reality of it. And, you know, Jim Keltner said to Porcaro, you know, when people were getting on Porcaro's ass about playing too many notes, he said something like, you know what, man, you just play it, play those notes. If that's what you hear,
right,
play it. This is the time to do it. You know, maybe someday you won't hear all those notes and you won't want to play all those notes.
Yeah.
I try to keep that in mind when I'm thinking about this and when I'm teaching and advising students. And even for myself, just keeping it in mind for myself, chops aren't, you know, inherently bad.
Right.
It comes down to taste and, you know, where you choose to speak in an overly verbose manner.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think where the gospel chops gets a bad rap, and maybe to some degree, deservedly so, what people do with it, what, like how much value people put on it and how much time it takes to get the skill set to be able to play like a Thomas Pridgen.
Right.
You know, that shit takes time. You got to put hours in unless, you know, even if you do come out of the womb with a great gift to play drums, which I'm sure Thomas did because he was playing his ass off at a very young age.
I know. It's crazy.
You know, you still got to work at it. Right. And some people have to work at it a lot more so than others. That shit takes time.
Yeah.
So it's like, you got to be careful because there's so much other shit to work on that is more important.
Right.
That's the thing.
Right.
You know? So if you're a young drummer and you're just working on your chops because you just want to have the most chops, it's like, you know, somebody who's just a greedy money hoarder who just their purpose in life is to just make a lot of money. If your purpose in life is to just play a lot of notes and that's it, well, then, you know, then you're going down the wrong path, unless you just are going to make videos in your, you know, your studio by yourself for
Correct.
The rest of your life.
Right.
And that is another component to this is
Absolutely.
The culture of just people playing by themselves, making
yeah.
records by themselves, even if they're making records with other people, they're still doing it in isolation and mm-hmm. long before COVID, you know, 19.
Right.
So that's a different thing too, man. It's like back in the day, you know, these people are on stage like Sammy Davis Jr. I watched a video recently of Sammy playing with a small big band. There were horns and such, but it wasn't like, I don't think it was a full-on big band, if I remember correctly. Acoustic piano, no mics on anything. There are probably a couple of overhead mics hanging from, you know, the rafters or however they did it, you know, hanging overhead out of sight of the camera. You must have had to listen like a mofo to lock in, you know, especially a big band. If you're a horn player on one side of the stage and you're a piano player on the other, you know, and by the way, this ensemble, they were like on top of each other. They
right.
were set up like right on top of each other, which makes sense. You know, they had to hear each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as a musician coming up in that era, you had to develop that skill to
yeah.
be able to play in a manner where you could hear everything,
absolutely,
you know, without it being turned up in your monitor because there was no monitor
right.
or your in-ear monitor because there was no in-ear monitor. You had to listen. So you had to develop a touch. You had to develop that skill set. So younger drummers, I think, are in danger of not ever seeing the need to develop that skill set.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe danger is too dramatic. My point is, if you're a young drummer, you learn to play a room. If you want to be a versatile drummer, learn to play a room. I struggled with that very much so when I was younger because, like I said, my MO was to hit really hard. And
mm-hmm.
you can't just do that every day and then have a gig where you can't do it and just say, oh, well, I can't do it. Okay, I'll play quietly.
Right.
That was extremely difficult for me to play quietly when I first started to have to play quietly.
Yeah.
So that's another component to this whole modern thing that's going on. You don't want to be a drummer who's just working on your chops night and day and playing as loud as you freaking can by yourself because it doesn't matter because
uh-huh.
you don't have to listen to anybody. Or you can turn your play along track up really loud in your in-ears and just beat the shit out of your drums.
Right.
You know, to me, I grew up where that would not be considered a real world skill.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Now it's a little more of a real world skill because it's more a part of the real world.
Yeah.
But, you know, so where do you want to draw that line?
I know.
I think young drummers should be thinking about that.
Yeah. No, absolutely, man. One of the distinctions that I made in talking to a recent guest was that in the sort of isolated vacuum of just posting the best take that you did of a specific fill, to be able to know where you are in the timing or tempo or whatever it is that you're playing, is an important skill. And it ties very much into something that I noticed that you tend to drive home pretty frequently, which is to count as you play. So you know not only where the pulse is, where the one is, but where you have a better grasp of where subdivisions are, et cetera. So I know, for instance, like JP Bavay, who I've spoken to and took a lesson with, he kind of stresses the importance of like the inherent melody and rudiments. And then someone like yourself kind of stresses the importance of pulse shape and space awareness and, you know, what you call the sort of above the neck discipline. So tell me, I guess, a little bit about sort of the importance of keeping time, even if you're blasting through chops, not to just maybe live in a world of isolated chops, but to incorporate those within grooves and have a sense of where you are in the measure.
Another good one, man. It's easy to make that shit sound unmusical, you
mm-hmm.
know, and I'm, you know, I won't put myself above that either. You know, I can, I don't think I'm above making that shit sound unmusical.
Yeah.
Although it certainly is my point to, if I'm expressing myself that way, to make it musical, just like any other type of expression that I would make, it's got to come from somewhere. You know, you don't want it to come from the licks. You don't want to be playing licks. I use those two terms synonymously, licks and words. You know, it's like we don't express ourselves. We use words to express ourselves, but the words are the means to the end. You know, if you're speaking in licks, then you're not actually communicating. You're saying words, but you're not actually communicating. There has to be a greater purpose. When I say a greater purpose, I mean like there has to be an idea. There has to be an idea that you're working from. There has to be a context. When I played that Modern Drummer Festival.
Oh, dude, by the way, I wanted to tell you, your drum solo on that is one of the greatest drum solos I think I've ever seen. It's incredible.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Holy shit.
Thank you. Thanks, Jody. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, man.
You know, that solo in particular largely was based around, I had 2-3 song clave in my head, and I was moving through different, you know, metric modulations, and you know, just using that as my muse, if you will, my point of reference, like a conversation piece that I would utilize to essentially sort of converse with myself, you know, basically. That way, if you can operate from that perspective, you know, you're going to stand a better chance of playing more musically, because you're behaving more like a conversationalist or a storyteller, in that you are maintaining focus on an idea while the words come out of your mouth in an effort to express the idea and expound upon the idea, elaborate upon it. They're following your mission to simply express an idea. So if you go boom, 4-1, but that to go back a goal, but the game, but that to go back to gap, like I could go on for another 5 minutes just sort of playing in and out of that. It's like almost like a ball of clay, and you know, you're manipulating that ball of clay into different shapes, but you're never putting that ball of clay down and picking up another one. So it's still the same ball of clay,
right? Yeah, man.
So I think if you can get, and this is at the crux of how I teach, how my books are laid out. If you can get operating from that perspective, then, you know, when you are playing 32nd notes or 16th note triplets or whatever, any dense, you know, note rate, you know, you stand a better chance of doing it in a musical fashion.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what you want to aim for. And if you're not, like I said, it's really easy to make that type of vocabulary sound shitty, boring.
Right, sure.
You know, boring is another thing, man. It's like I think of one clinic in particular of a great drummer. And it was like a PASIC PASIC convention, and I'm sitting at this clinic, this monster drummer's up there doing a solo, and I started to nod off.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I'm not saying the drumming put me to sleep, but it certainly didn't keep me awake, you
right
know?
yeah
It just started to sound like a drone, you know?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, And that same thing, if you're listening to, that's the same shit that used to happen to me in high school, you know, listening to a teacher just frickin' in monotone, like sure. not inspiring me and like yeah. struggling to stay awake.
Yeah. 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 I hear you. I think one of the distinctions that I would say about sort of what we're talking about here, and that it's one of the tricky things that I've found in my own playing, is that while you ultimately want to get to where within a certain amount of space, you could sort of get into a flow mode, for lack of a better phrase, to the extent that you're not really thinking so much about it. You're just kind of, as you said, sort of having a conversation and elaborating on it the same way we're doing right now. That's kind of what you want within your own playing. But I think the trick is that at some point you have to invest so heavily in the technical aspect to get you to a place to where you don't need to think about it anymore, that you can just live within that space, so to speak. That's the tricky part, because you do have to put in the time and effort and the tech. And I think about some of the more technical aspects of it to develop the vocabulary to put you in a place to where you have a broad enough vocabulary to work within that sort of flow mode, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. And I agree. So yeah, you know, you're right. Like, you have to, there's a lot of things to put in place before you can get to that flow mode that you were talking about. And I think where younger drummers get in trouble is they put too much emphasis on the development of the vocabulary and not enough emphasis on hearing that vocabulary in context, sure. i.e., you know, playing that vocabulary in a context and hearing the context at the same time, you know? Right. I mean, it's the oldest problem in the book is like, one of them is, you know, you go to play this cool lick and you stop hearing the quarter note because right. you're so wrapped up in the rendition of the lick.
Mm-hmm.
And so you stop hearing your context. You know, and there's time context and there's rhythmic context.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be in control of both. And this is where my concept of pulse, space, shape, awareness comes in. So look, if we talk about pulse, space, shape, awareness, that's the pulse and the space of the music that the music is sitting in. And then there's the shape that you're playing. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the shapes of what everybody else is playing.
Sure.
So, again, I come back to that, like, becoming a great musician is a tall order. And I think it's one of the reasons most of us, will be fascinated by it till the day we die. Because we're yeah. still learning all the time. We're mm-hmm. still getting better because there's so much to get better at.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the counting for a second. This is important because I think it gets misconstrued sometimes that I count when I play. I never count when I'm performing
right.
or recording, unless I absolutely have to mm-hmm. to get through a passage or something.
Yeah.
So it's in practice that you use your voice. And I recommend, again, anybody who's listening, young or older, whatever, you know, if you need to work on this skill, work on it. And the skill is you've got to be able to hear outside of what you play.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be able to hear outside of what you play. And you can use the voice as a tool to develop that skill. So can you play straight time, whatever style, and subdivide the permutations of a quarter note with your voice over the top of what you play and not be affected by what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's tough.
Meaning, you know, so you've got the above the neck and below the neck, the voice and the drums, mm-hmm. the voice and the body, and you want them to be interdependent of one another.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the common thing that I see with my students is I ask them to say, count, you know, subdivide a quarter note in a 16th note grid and accentuate the quarter note, one in a two in a, and so forth. And then ask them to accentuate the E of each beat with the hand clap. So you're having to send two opposite signals to each limb within 2/16 notes. So it's like you got to go wandy with the voice, and with the hand clap, you go clap, clap. The exact opposite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this, and if you do it slowly and deliberately enough, and you listen to what you're saying, especially to what you're saying, and if you recognize the moments that that juxtaposition happens, mm-hmm. if you notice in those moments, if you capture those moments with your, I suppose your intellect, ultimately it is, to me, that's when you know you're starting to develop your oral cerebral coordination, how much you can hear and process simultaneously.
Yeah.
Woo! And the shit works. the shit works, man. Like, I can hear better than not my auditory skills, but my listening skills are better than they've ever been. I can hear a lot, no matter what I'm playing, I can hear a lot outside of it, and vice versa. I can play a lot outside of what I hear.
Yeah. Wow.
And this is freedom. And this is a way to become, a way to become more musical with the vocabulary that you do have.
Right.
So maybe the advice here is be mindful, drummers, of how much time you're spending on, just cultivating new vocabulary after new vocabulary, and start to work on how to use that vocabulary in musical ways.
Mm-hmm. Nice, man. Early on, when you were kind of in your metal phase, and then I'll take it more present, what were some of the drummers that you were really digging at the time?
So my proper metal phase started in 1988. Because prior to that, I was playing metal. No, that's not true. That's not true at all, actually. I was into metal long before that. I was also into a lot of prog and hard rock, stuff that I didn't necessarily consider metal.
Right.
I just posted something with Vinny Appice.
Oh, he's one of my favorites.
Oh, dude.
He's so good.
A bad motherfucker.
Oh, God.
He's so great, man. And I saw Vinny. So I just shared a post of him teaching online. It was so cool, man. He's he's teaching, some of his vocabulary that he used on some of the Dio records and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was just really fun to watch. And it reminded me how much I love his playing.
Yeah.
And I followed him. He was definitely an influence back in that time for me. He was the first drummer I saw in an arena setting.
Wow.
I saw Black Sabbath, the Mob Rules tour. That was the first arena concert.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was awesome, man. It was so great.
I bet
it was. So great.
Oh.
And, so Vinny, Tommy Aldridge.
Yeah.
Sure. I loved Tommy Lee. I thought Tommy Lee was great.
Yeah.
I also loved bands
that
I wasn't necessarily like, nerding out over the drummer, like Judas Priest.
Of course.
Like I loved Screaming for Vengeance, that album.
Oh, that record's just shit, man.
Yeah, man.
I had that on vinyl. I was obsessed with it as a kid. My God. I still listen to that record. It rules. It's badass, man.
Oh, that's great. That's great, man. Yeah, I love that record. And Dave Holland is not necessarily a drummer that I would say I'm influenced by, per se.
Uh-huh.
But, I love that music. So, by default, I would say, in a way, it's like if you love the music, it's like you love everybody who's involved in playing the music.
Totally.
So in a way, I would say, I think Dave Holland, I love Dave Holland, but not necessarily an influence like Vinny was. Tommy Aldridge was a big influence. John Bonham was a huge influence for me.
Yeah.
Although I don't even think back then I got fully understood the magnitude of how great John Bonham was in terms of his sound and his feel.
Absolutely. I hear his influence more so in your playing more recently than when I've, because I've watched videos of you over the years, and more recently I hear more of that sort of, like I was saying, sort of maybe, you know, Mike Clark, Harvey Mason slash John Bonham kind of thing, for sure. I hear that in your playing.
Well, I'm glad you hear that. That makes me happy to hear.
Yeah.
So yeah, man, those are some of the drummers. I want to give you a couple more. I was into Alan White from Yes.
Yeah.
I had that live Yes Songs record, man. Oh my God, I used to play to that. My dad's drums.
Really?
Cranking speakers, the floor speakers on either side of me.
Oh wow.
Playing Heart of the Sunrise.
And oh wow.
Tunes like that.
Bill Bruford, I've always leaned towards, obviously, because I'm just a fan of like Fragile and some of those records, Closer to the Edge, et cetera. But there's some really cool shit out there with Alan White as well.
I actually agree with you. I like those records better. Like, I like those, like the Yes album, the first record, and
yeah.
Fragile.
Oh, yeah.
Close to the Edge.
Oh, yeah.
Love those records. Although, I gotta say, I've never been a fan of Bill Bruford.
Interesting, really?
Yeah, you know, I feel like funny saying that. Like, I don't even really want to say that about people,
yeah,
you know, because
right.
It's just such a small world. And Bill Bruford contributed so much, man, you know, to the world of drumming and music. But it just wasn't my cup of tea, man. It was a little on the thin side for me, the thin sounding
yeah.
side, a little bit more perpendicular, like, than I would sort of gravitate toward, like where Bonham was a little more sideways, like a little more like, you know, there's a little hunch to his groove. It wasn't like perfectly upright, you know?
Right, right.
So, but I loved those Yes records, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
So, bro, I could probably go on and on, man. There was a lot of drummers that I was really influenced by. But
yeah, of course.
Simon Phillips was another one when I was younger.
Oh, man.
Well, Neil Peart was an influence for a period of time as well when I was younger, coming
right.
up in, you know, high school and so forth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow, man.
Yeah, man.
That's good to hear. I know, a whole lot of drummers, whole lot of drumming talk. That's the way it goes.
Yeah. Yeah, man, it's been good talking to you, Jody. I've enjoyed this, man.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Dave, it was fun catching up. Well, like you said, we've been trying to make it happen for a while, so I'm glad we finally did. I definitely had a few questions in particular, as an educator in yourself, and especially at a place like Berkeley, where I was just kind of curious as to the origins of some of this stuff. So you helped kind of confirm and elaborate on some of that stuff and all the other good stuff that we touched on. So again, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Hey, man. My pleasure, Jody. I appreciate your interest. And if you ever have any more questions and you want to do this again, just hit me up and we'll hang out again sometime.
Right on, Dave. Good talking to you, buddy.
You too, Jody. Have a great night, man.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening. Thanks for Dave for rapping and fielding some of my questions about drumming trends and their origins, as well as his insights into flow modes, expanding one's vocabulary, and much more. We'll have to do another one soon. That was too good. Crash, bang, boom.